Wow, I just found a kindred spirit in Dennis Allen. It's unlikely that an Air Force fighter pilot and an Army Ranger would hit it off like we did on this episode. But man, listening to Dennis, everything about this guy's heart is where my heart is. And in this episode, you not only get a chance to hear from one of the masters of the air, Air Force fighter pilot, but a guy who has turned around corporations and is now taking on, in my opinion, the most important challenge in world history. Dennis and I have a very real, very honest conversation about making leaders who are trained and equipped to make other leaders. We're going to talk about this word, disciple, on this episode of Unbeatable.
These stories of triumph over adversity will help you handle your toughest days in life and become unbeatable.
Dennis, thank you for being willing to be a guest on this episode of Unbeatable with me.
I'm amped to be with you, Dr. Jeff Strucker. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you a story, and it's a true story. I wish I would have probably given my right arm or my right leg to have an Air Force fighter pilot over my head about 30 years ago when I was on the ground in Mogadishu, Somalia, under some extremely restrictive rules of engagement. And in the middle of this firefight, as you know, that becomes known as Black Hawk Down, and we don't have any close air support. There's no naval gunfire. There's no artillery. There's nothing that we can bring to bear in this fight that causes collateral damage. And then there's a couple of us that are taken. There's several of our task force that's missing in action, killed in action, or Mike Durant taken prisoner of war. And 24 hours later, President Clinton sends a special envoy over to Somalia to try to negotiate the release of Durant, to try to get those American bodies back. And that's the first moment that I started to hear Air Force and Navy jets flying low and fast over our heads in Somalia. And those jets brought Idid and his team to the table and made them start negotiating because of the fear of those jets. So it's an incredible honor for me to be able to talk to a former Air Force fighter pilot and have just an honest conversation about the way that you're helping lead leaders today.
Well, thank you. It's awfully easy to be in an air-conditioned office looking down on the guys in the chaos like you who are going through the real gunfire when, you know, we're moving around at 600 knots and just saying, we'll let the air conditioner keep running and we'll take out anybody that gets in our way. Yeah. Thank you for your service and what you've done.
Well, with service to air and air to air missiles, although you might be sitting in an air conditioned cockpit, you do still have, you know, you are still putting your life on the line up there. I think the best way to talk about the leader that you are is to talk about some of those formative leadership experiences. So let's go back to how you ended up flying F-15s for the United States Air Force. Can you talk a little bit about how you were, why that was a dream of yours and what it took for you to pursue that dream?
Maybe like you and some of the people who are listening to your podcast, there's this moment in life where you're staring into a television commercial or you see something in real life and it just burns into your soul and you go, that's me. That's my identity. Yep. I have to be there. I have to do that. And, you know, I was sort of laughing about reading, I was creeping your page before we jumped on today, you know, and your story in third grade, right? About the Jeff in third grade, which folks, you haven't read that one. That's kind of interesting. But there's that Jeff who realized who he wanted to be and where he wanted to be. And it became clear that the mission that was lined up in the Air Force with that kind of high moving, fast moving airplane was that was my love song and I had to go for that. And if I could only get there, right, life would be perfect. So that was the calling. And I had people alongside me. I had some mentors that came alongside me, Jeff, who started saying, that can be your destiny. If you're willing to run that race, if you're willing to follow me, if you're willing to listen to me, we can get you there. Do you want to do it?
Who were some of those mentors that came alongside you and said, this is going to be hard work, but if you're willing to do the hard work, I'm willing to help you, you know, figure out how to get there?
One of the scariest stories in my life was when I had kind of landed as a new lieutenant in Japan at the 18th Fighter Wing. And, you know, I kind of know how to fly the jet. And after a couple of months, people are looking at me. And this guy walks up to me, and he's one of the Jedi Knights in the F-15. He's one of the really feared guys. Yeah. His name is Ken Fox, F-O-X, but his call sign is Sly.
Sly
and
Fox.
Sly's
like
one
it.
Of those guys. Yeah, you know the call sign. You got the call sign. And Sly's one of those guys, if you get in a dogfight with Sly, you're going to die. It's a question of maybe 15 seconds, 90 seconds. Mm-hmm. You're going to die. You know, he's going to get you. He walks up to me in the hall and he said, your name's Alan, right? And I said, yes, sir. He said, have I seen you over at the chapel, son? Yes, sir. He said, I've seen you around the squadron. I've watched you fly once. He said, you're coming with me.
Okay.
And suddenly,
just like that.
I'm like, I'm doing what? He said, you're coming with me. You're going to become an instructor pilot. You're going to learn how to fly and fight the jet in ways you've never learned before. You're coming with me, and we're going to go do this. And we're going to do this both for the purposes of the Air Force and purposes we're going to talk about later on, which have some really interesting long-term implications.
Nice.
That was one example.
Well, thank God for guys like Sly Fox in your life. I want to make sure that the listeners know you're flying jets in the 80s and 90s. Is that right? Or did you start flying in the, in the
80s 70s? And 90s. Yeah. We rolled the F-15 out really operationally in the early 80s. And I was one of the kids that got to jump in early.
So for people that don't understand U.S. military, or they don't understand, you know, kind of recent military history, our Air Force has always been phenomenal. Ever since we established this branch way back in late 1940s, our Air Force has always been world class. But there was a period of time where our Air Force just left all of the air forces of the world in the dust. And it just happened to be in the 80s and 90s. And we our Air Force became in a league, literally playing in a league all on their own, and nobody else in the world was within 20 years. And it's not the technology, it was how talented and how incredible those pilots were. And it was during that time that you were flying the F-15 that our Air Force really just took off and left the rest of the world's air power in the dust. And you had a chance to fly and to be part of that, you know, kind of unprecedented part of U.S. military history.
It's a phenomenal experience to get into any organization where they say, we believe in you. We're going to walk alongside you. We're going to start teaching you the best of what we know so that when the worst of what can possibly happen, and this is almost a story that would fit in your world too, Jeff, when the worst that can possibly happen, at least in all of the franticness, you know who you are and you know what you're supposed to be about. Whether the technology's there or not, you know who you are. You know where you are. You know what you're about. Yeah, that was a really wonderful experience. By the way, a shout out, if you just want to get a sense of kind of the military's world that both Jeff and I have been involved in, if you catch Masters of the Air as a series on TV right now, fabulous story about the person, not the technology, but the person, whether it's the Tuskegee Airmen or bombers or whatever. Great story about that.
I love it because I wanted to make sure that the audience heard, yes, we have incredible technology. Yeah, our aircraft are just world class, but that's not what made us in a league on our own. It was guys like you and guys and gals like you that were frankly so talented and so committed that the U.S. Air Force left the rest of the world's air power in the dust. I couldn't help but think, I was sitting in the dust in Afghanistan. I haven't told this story before, but I was in a tent. I was leading a little Bible study for some warriors in the dust in Afghanistan, and we were just getting ready to come off of a combat mission, and our battalion's air liaison officer was in the little Bible study. We're kind of going around the room talking a little bit, and I'll never forget Ryan's words. Ryan said, I'm just a fighter pilot. So basically, what can I bring to the kingdom of God? And I started falling on the ground laughing. And he got a little bit upset, or I think he got hurt by my reaction. And I said, Ryan, would you think about the insanity of the words you just said? I'm just a fighter pilot in the United States Air Force. What do I know, or what can I do? I said, less than 1/10 of 1% of the world could do what you do. And many, many people would give their right arm to be able to do what you do and can't. So when you put the word just in there, it kind of becomes comical to me. And for most guys, Dennis, the worst thing in the world that could ever happen to a fighter pilot is to lose the ability to fly for the United States Air Force anymore, which is kind of what happened to you. Can you talk about what happened there?
Yeah, I was actually hanging upside down on my straps about 170 miles offshore from Japan, and the flight surgeon pops in on the back radio and said, "Where are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm hanging upside down, getting ready to go down and take a gunshot on a little guy below me here." And he said, "Roll the airplane upright, bring it home." What got me was the same thing that got Pistol Pete Maravich on the Boston Celtics. It was a heart defect that wouldn't allow, it was my muscles were actually just growing inside my heart and choking out my capacity to pump blood. And they said, "That's your last flight in an airplane." So my world, which I wanted desperately, just stopped.
Just like that, they found the heart condition, and that became your last pilot, or your last flight in that airplane.
Yeah, that echocardiogram 6 months earlier finally went through the bureaucracy, and then went, "Get that guy home and get him on the ground." That was game over.
And for the listener out there, I have had one or two people that I know in the military that had this medical condition. Nobody knew that they had this medical condition until they literally died right next to us in some extremely difficult training event. And nobody knew about the condition of their heart until it was too late. So thank God they found it in that EKG instead of finding out too late.
Yeah, this is kind of the world, I think, of the regular life. The regular life is filled with stuff we don't expect to have happen. And the question becomes then, why am I really here? What is my destiny? What's my mission and my purpose? And how am I going to deal with this thing that just got in the way? Maybe like you thought about as the bullets were flying and there was no air cover and stuff was getting bad.
I think every listener right now has had or will have the experience that you've had. Everything in their life has pointed towards this dream. I want to pursue this dream. If I only reach this goal, then all of my life will have meaning. Everything, I'll be satisfied deep inside. And they, A, either never get a chance to make it to that goal for some reason, or B, even worse, they achieve that goal. And then when they get there, they realize, oh man, this totally let me down. It didn't deliver satisfaction deep inside my soul like I thought it would. And now they're sitting there with this conundrum. What do I do with the rest of my life? So when you couldn't fly anymore, what did you decide to do with the rest of your life, Dennis?
Well, it was sort of a rapid shutdown, and I had a firstborn on the way, about 2 months out, thinking that I was going to be flying for the rest of my life. And we ended up asking for some help from some friends on the base to get us back to the United States. We were in Japan at the time, and picked up a job in the Pentagon. And for a year, I was hunting for what's next, because I didn't want to fly a desk for the rest of my life. I wanted to get out in the real world.
Totally know where you're coming from right there. For me, that would be like a slow form of torture.
Yeah, I just didn't want to do that. And so in the Pentagon, I started hunting for work in the civilian world. And that's when I entered the dark side of the force and began becoming a capitalist.
I love your language. You became a capitalist. Let's just get real with each other. You started leading leaders, and you started leading organizations at a very high level, like CEO of 6 companies in your tenure. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of leadership that you've been able to do with some of those companies and those boards?
Yeah. So my resume reads like an attention deficit disorder nightmare. You know, when you look at all the different industries that I've been involved with.
He is the quintessential CEO with ADHD. We're just going to throw all of those letters into one right now.
Yeah, which by the way is a key criteria to be a good fighter pilot. They need ADD in that too. Yeah. So just saying. But in the world of organizations, one of the things that I noticed is that the Wall Street companies that are out there buying up corporations, that's a very popular thing. You think about Blackstone, Lehman Brothers, JP, all these folks that you could see in the nightly news buy corporations. And the idea is buy them, build up their value, sell them to somebody else and go buy
low,
money.
Sell high. Money. Yeah. Age old.
Sure. Buy low, sell high. Right. And so in this world, I got to go into these corporations because occasionally they'd broke them. They would walk in going, we have a spreadsheet. This is how we want the corporation to work. Uh-huh. We forget that there's human beings
and
in there.
Culture already, right?
You've got a culture. Beautiful. I'm glad that you used that word because that's so important. And so you get into these organizations and you realize that culture is wrecked. And very interestingly, nobody knows why they're there. People are living in their ivory tower offices or they're out on the factory floor. And they just do what they do. It's just routine, monotonous stuff that people are going, why am I here? What am I supposed to do? So my world as a CEO has really been about, if I were to just tell you the secret sauce, it's basically get out of the way, find really talented people in the organization who need to be in the right spots. As Jim Collins would say, put the right people in the right seats on the right bus. And then take the people that don't want to be on the bus and graciously walk them out the door and just say, we can't help you. You can't help us. This doesn't work. And you start seeing this group of people looking at you and going, Jeff, tell me why I'm here. And if you can tell that story, this is who you are. This is why you personally are important. And this is why we're here and what we're here to do. Life and trajectories, businesses and performance take on a whole new level of performance.
Yeah, that... I am a student of human nature. And one of the things that most fascinates me about human nature is how people function with each other in organizations. In other words, I could spend the next 3 hours nerding out with you about organizational culture, what it is, what it's not, when it's beautiful and when it's not. And I've been around organizations that have incredibly strong, amazing cultures. I've seen organizations that have very weak and very, hostile cultures. And I've seen how people struggle in one and how they flourish in another. But I'm going to have to discipline myself, Dennis, because if not, I'm going to just spend the next 3 hours talking organizational culture with you. I love your description of it's really not that complex. Just get out of the way, find some talented people, help the people that are not so talented or not so committed off of the bus using Jim Collins' language, and then give them some meaning that attaches deep to their soul, meaning that's more important than just a pay raise or a promotion in the corporation, right?
Gen Z and millennials more than any generations prior. Like, you know, I'm male, pale, straight, and stale. People are going to look at me and go, you know.
I love that description.
You're welcome to it. So as we think about that, what's changed in the world is the millennials and the Gen Zs, think 45 years of age and down, they're asking this question, not how much money are you going to pay me? Not, you know, what kind of things do you want me to do? They're asking why am I here? Why does it matter that I'm here? And this is where leaders have to step up and go, we are responsible for that. If you can tell people in your organizations why they're there, you just change the game in an organization. Most people forget that.
Yeah, I'm thinking right now of combat deployments that I was on, and I watched the boss, and maybe they did this unintentionally, maybe it was very intentionally, but right before they all got on aircraft and got ready to fly overseas somewhere to go do a dangerous mission, the boss reminded everybody, every single person in this organization has incredible value, and here's what's at stake if we don't win. And when the conversation was over, it lasted 5 minutes, 15 minutes. When it was over with, every single person in that formation, every person in that group decided, I'm going to give whatever it takes. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to be successful on the battlefield because the boss just gave meaning to my role. And now I see how I fit in the bigger picture. And it occurred to me, like, I wish more leaders recognized just how powerful that is. because people will make incredible sacrifices. They will make amazing contributions if they just understand what they're doing matters to the overall big picture.
You were willing to run through the wall for these guys because of what they told you, right?
100%. Yep.
And I think we just come up with this view of the universe that I can just walk in with a PowerPoint chart in front of 100 people and say, hey, we're all here to make money or make widgets or we're in the military. That's not how the military does it. And that's not how good leaders in the corporate world and the church world do it.
Absolutely. You've not only led corporations well, helped them actually get healthy after a fracture because of a buyout, but you're coaching and leading others to do it. And it sounds like you're being very effective at leading other leaders. There's lots and lots of people listening right now that said, man, if I could just be the man for a day, if I could make it to the corner office and be the person making all of the decisions, if I could just reach that level one day, the proverbial brass ring, if I could just grab the brass ring, then my life would be satisfying. Then it would be fulfilling. And many of those people don't recognize what you've seen, in other leaders, what you've experienced yourself, Dennis, that it just gets harder at that level. And oftentimes it leaves you disappointed at the challenges, not the satisfaction at that level. Can you talk about that for just a little bit?
I have to imagine in your career, having again crimped your world and looked at some of the places you've spoken and the people you've met a lot of very, very successful people who don't sleep well at night because they got to the top of the mountain and there's nothing there. C.S. Lewis would call it the great it that was not there. And we find that whether you're thinking, I want to be a CEO, a lot of people in the business world, I want to be a CEO. I just get to be a CEO. Uh-huh. I sit in the big chair. I drink the lemonade. I point to people and say, go do this, go do that. Probably just like the life of a pastor, right? You just tell people and everything works.
That's exactly how it works in business and in the church.
Amen for that. But you get into this role and what you begin to realize is that the way that it works at the CEO chair is precisely the same way that it works on the factory floor. It's the guy or the gal on your right or your left being able to hear from you that you are amped because you know why you're there and you can flow that amping into their lives to know why they are there and you can make them feel important. That's how you make corporations really perform well, whether it's the Fortune 100 or it's the mom and pop shop down the street. Now, a lot of people don't get that that's how a Jeff influences his Rangers and how CEOs influence people. It's one-on-one. Yeah. It's not big groups.
Yeah. There's only been a couple of times in my life but I'll never forget these moments where everything kind of pointed to one moment in time. And I walked into work that day saying, I know exactly why I'm on planet Earth. I know exactly what I'm supposed to be doing right now. And although it's very, very difficult to do, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else on the world than doing what I'm doing right now. And I could look other people in the eyes and say, I know exactly why I'm here and what I'm supposed to do with myself. And it is a good feel. What I'm trying to tell people that are listening is that is a very good feeling to have. But when you're not sure why I'm here, when you're not sure what you're contributing to the overall mission, that's miserable.
It's really a difficult world that we live in because it has us riven. You know, you have the digital landscape telling you if only you buy this product, or if only you listen to this speaker, or if only you participate in this particular vocation or this recreation, if only you go to the top of this mountain, the gods will be there and you will be happy and fulfilled and life will be terrific and wonderful. And that becomes incredibly distracting for us, right? That's the thousands and thousands. I was even hearing you on a talk one time talking about this, the thousands and thousands of digital distractions that need to be narrowed down so that we're not catechizing ourselves. That's a technical term. Sorry for throwing that out, folks. But how I rehearse my life every day, am I drilled into just watching television and putting an hour into thinking who I am, or am I spending hours and hours about who I am, where I am, why I am, and maybe catching a little TV? How do I find meaning and purpose?
Wow. That, folks, if you're not processing what he's saying right now, I can't stress how important it is to spend the time sitting there thinking, am I doing what I've been created to do? Am I becoming the man or the woman that I know I should be? Because when you are sitting in that sweet spot right there, man, the world feels, it feels amazing. You still got lots of problems, but it's amazing. And when you're not, man, it's miserable. Even if you're doing well and you're getting promoted and pay raises, it's still miserable.
I was just going to say, you think about people. One of the most prominent people that made this statement was Lee Iacocca. He created the Ford Mustang.
Yeah, and then he went over to Chrysler and became a business icon for about 20 years. Yep,
top of the hill. And if you read his biography, at the beginning he says, "I have no idea what I was doing there that mattered to anybody."
Wow,
and I have no idea why I even exist as a result of looking at this. Tom Brady, same thing. New England Patriots is like fourth Super Bowl ring, and he goes, "What's it all really about, man? Like, I got these. Now what?"
Yeah, and there's countless examples of the famous movie stars, musicians, you know, super famous people, super rich, with all kinds of influence, that decided, I'm going to take some pills or I'm going to drive my car off of a cliff tonight because life is miserable. I've got literally everything the world can offer and I'm miserable and it's not satisfying, and it's because they're chasing the wrong dream. So I was about to say,
when you are thinking about this, you know, why do I actually exist?
That's exactly
right.
Is
it my vocation or my family or what? Why am I here?
The question that humanity is asking since the earliest days. I was just thinking, you and I have been around the block for a while. And when I was growing up,
more than you, brother.
Most of America had this vision of business, and it was always positive. Most people had the, I'm going to go to work at a corporation. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to give it 30 or 40 years. And one of these days, if I'm super successful, I'll be able to make it to that corner office. And then I don't even know exactly when this happened, but maybe sometime in the last 20 or 30 years, America's opinion of business itself started to change. America's idea of what it looks like to be super successful at the end of life started to change. And definitely during the mid-2000s economic recession, people started to get really angry with business, very jaded about business. They started looking down on big business instead of thinking about it positively. And today, it seems like, at least in our country, a prevailing thought is there is an inherent distrust or at least a dislike for really big business, really big corporations. Somehow, for some reason, things changed. Can you speak to this cataclysmic tectonic shift in the way that we view business between the time you and I were young and the way that America looks at business today?
Well, I think one of the interesting conversations in this vein comes from a fellow you can catch on YouTube known as Neil Ferguson, N-I-A-L-L, Neil Ferguson, who is a professor at Stanford, has been Oxford, has been Cambridge, has been Harvard, and he talks about what we call the theory of money. And if you watch this conversation with Neil Ferguson, who used to be an atheist, and he now refers to himself as a lapsed atheist, by the way.
I like that terminology.
Yeah, lapsed atheist. And he said, because there's no answer in the capitalist worldview unless there is something more to it all. Here we have that it showing up.
That's the C.S. Lewis it, yep.
Yeah, and so we have this idea that at some point in life, the American economic system began to deeply distill its capacity to generate profitability. And it was done on the short-term notion that what you can do for me in the next few months or next couple of years, I will reward you handsomely for. And frankly, it comes down to this kind of a statement, Jeff. If profit is king, why in the world do I need ethics? Profit is king, why do I need ethics? And we find ourselves in this world of like, actually, I don't need ethics. My mission's to get rich.
That's right. Do whatever you got to do to get rich then.
So then adapting to what we would call the Charles Darwin theory of have a blast while you last, you know, just kind of go out there in life and do what makes you feel good, validate yourself. We said to ourselves, well, we can exploit people. We can take money out of their pockets and out of their wallets and out of their minds and out of their souls. And I can accrue these great benefits for myself and I'll get out of there before the lawyers and the stockholders figure out something bad happened.
Before the whole thing falls in on itself, right?
Yeah, yeah. So we thought that meaning was found in profitability and meaning was found in wealth accumulation and meaning is found in prosperity. Except for a lot of my friends today, some of whom they're not even alive anymore, Jeff, because they found out that once they got there, that mountain
was vacant too. It totally let them down. Yep. Yeah. There's some people that are driving right now listening to this episode and they're thinking to yourself, hold on just a second, Dennis. Everything about my life has been about making a little bit, working harder so I can get a promotion and a pay raise and making a little bit of money. Because if I make a little bit more, then I won't have to deal with the stresses and the challenges that I'm going through. If I have a little bit more, then I'll finally be happy and finally be content on the inside. And what you just said is ground shaking to them, because what you're saying is there is no amount of more that's going to give you that thing.
Once you arrive at the top of that hill, you're going to find that your hard work doesn't matter anymore to anyone and your wealth is useless to you. And I think about David Bonson is a guy that is on the internet. He's an investment banker off the West Coast. He just finished a book called Full Time. And he's talking about why it is necessary to work very hard. And he talks about the mission behind that. But he said that working hard for working hard's sake for the accumulation of prosperity and wealth isn't going anywhere. And that kind of echoes another statement. Francis Schaeffer, a well-known philosopher in years gone by, made the statement that our society is collapsing into personal peace and prosperity. We will pursue prosperity at all costs so that we can have personal peace, only to arrive at the end of the road and realize there is no peace and the prosperity didn't matter. Why are you driving down the road thinking about working harder right now? What's your mission? Why are you there?
Famous example. 2,000 years ago, Jesus had a group of people around him, and he said there was this guy, he was a farmer. He was extremely successful, so successful. Bumper crop came in. I'm going to tear down my barns. I'm going to build bigger barns. I'm going to put all of my crop there. I'm going to be rich, and I'm going to be happy for the rest of my life. And he sits there at the end of the day, having all of this bumper crop now in these brand new barns, not a care in the world. And Jesus asked the question, you fool. Don't you realize that even tonight your soul will be demanded of you? And then what does all of this stuff matter? Like, even if it could satisfy you, and what you and I are both saying is it obviously can't, even if it could satisfy you, what does it matter 2 seconds after you leave this world?
It's interesting, Jeff, to me that we actually live in a world, especially in the West, with two theories underpinning. One is the one that you just raised, which suggests there's something larger and more meaningful. The other one says your life is totally hopeless and totally meaningless. So accumulate as many toys as you possibly can by working as hard as you possibly can, get as much as you possibly can, and then you die. And so the question that I think sits on both corporate life as well as any sort of spiritual reflection, as well as any sort of personal reflection we might have, is which narrative actually holds up? Because if meaninglessness is all that there is, what meaning is there in what you're doing? And if meaning does exist in a larger sense, this Jesus perhaps saying, why are you sweating the barns? There's a bigger, better thing here. Yeah. The it. I'm about to talk to you about the it is what Jesus is suggesting.
Yeah. I'll tell you a quick story, be very brief about this, but you're welcome, Dennis, to use this sometime when you're working with clients. I spent most of my years as a Ranger NCO pursuing the best Ranger competition. And I mean, every day, all day long, even when the competition was, even when there, we weren't training for the competition, I was working hard and diligently giving myself totally to trying to win this thing. Competed for 3 years in a row and came in fourth place in 1995, fourth place in 1990 or 1994 and 95. And I thought, that's it. That's as good as I'll ever get. Like, I've given it my all. Literally, I can't train any harder, can't compete any better. In 1996, I competed one final time. And that year, my partner and I won the Best Ranger competition. And I'll never forget the morning after the competition was over with. I was shaving my face, putting my uniform on, getting ready to go to the award ceremony, receive the pistols and all of the accolades. And everybody in the world, everybody in the military is going to elevate you to superstardom that day. And I remember looking in the mirror and saying, what do I do with my life now? Everything that I've ever done has been to get me to this moment. I'm here. And it totally let me down. And I don't even know what I'm going to do with myself tomorrow now that I've got here. And what I'm trying to say is it didn't give me the thing that I want, the thing that I thought it would. Now, I don't know that I turned Best Ranger into an idol per se, but I certainly pursued it with every ounce of energy for years. And when I finally got there, it was the ultimate letdown. And I really feel like
proverbial dog caught the proverbial car.
Yeah, billions of people live their life that way. Not all of them will actually get to the it that C.S. Lewis was describing, but billions of people are going to spend every ounce of their energy chasing something. And God forbid, and I'm using this language very literally, you get it, because when you get there, like Alexander the Great, you weep because there's no more empires left to conquer and it lets you down. So we're dancing all around this. And now, Dennis, I just want you to go ahead and just be bold with it. We're basically saying a life without meaning is miserable. So what does a life with meaning look like? What does it look like to really know your purpose and then knock it out of the park?
The question that I think comes up a lot in business conversations, as well as conversations around it, regard identity, meaning, purpose, and community that surrounds that identity, meaning, and purpose. We are all seeking the it. Who am I? Why am I? What am I to do with this? And who will come along with me on this journey? And what I have found is that the most successful senior executives and fighter pilots that I have been around who did not know who they were frittered away quickly after they got top honors, top bonuses, top monies. This is my appeal to the people who are listening to this podcast. If you want real identity, meaning, and purpose, the it is found in the fact that God actually exists, described beautifully in the Bible, and has come to earth, taken on scars, and died. And he said, you follow me. Just like my buddy Sly Fox, who said,
you are coming with me.
You're coming with me. And Sly Fox said, we're going to go fly and fight in this airplane, and we're going to serve Christ. And when I thought about that, I thought, well, I don't want to give up, you know, what I want to do, right? But he taught me the achievements that you're about to experience, and they happened, suddenly became just a moment in life.
Yeah.
Because my vision was pointed ahead on my identity, my never ending, no retirement plan, no opting out, call to the mission of being a servant of Christ, which is the most liberating, marvelous identity building, purpose building, meaning building experience I could have ever had. Would you consider the possibility of taking a deep dive on who is this Jesus, this Christ? That would be my appeal.
That's fascinating. You're using language that a guest that we had months ago, a good friend of mine, Kyle Lamb, said. and Kyle and I shares our faith, but Kyle said, every man and woman on the planet must have a mission. And the guy or the gal that doesn't know their mission when they get up tomorrow is going to be a miserable creature. It doesn't matter what kind of car is in the driveway. It doesn't matter what kind of house you live in or how fat your bank account. If you don't know your mission, and if you're not living for your mission, you will be a miserable human being. And Kyle's challenge is, don't ever let go of a mission, your mission. Keep pursuing it until you're 105 years old.
I think that's something that a lot of people would get really nervous about, right? Like, I'm supposed to be able to just play golf and kick it off at age 58 or whatever, right?
Right off into the sunset in your golden years.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, you know people, I know people, I've seen so many people, they retired and they died.
Yes, they did. Literally, he's not exaggerating, literally 3, 4, 5 years after retiring, they're dead because they had nothing left to live for. I know dozens of them.
They got to the hill, yep. And there's nothing on the top of the hill, yeah.
All right, so what you're talking about definitely permeates the business culture. Let's just be honest, it permeates the military culture. There are endless amounts of men and women who will pursue rank and awards and promotions because they're hoping it's going to give them meaning, and it doesn't. But if we're honest, some of this has creeped into the church. I should say crept in. That's terrible language. Some of it has crept into the church. And Dennis, I have enormous respect for you and your willingness to just challenge this in the church. So I'm just going to give you free rein now to talk about the book, The Disciple Dilemma, and why you wrote it and what you hope the book will do.
The book, perversely, is actually not about discipleship, even though the title is The Disciple Dilemma. The book is a letter to leaders in the Christian community, and it asks this question: have you allowed churchianity to take over your Christianity?
Oh, man. Hold on, I got to write that down because that is a great question. Go for it.
Have you been part of 1800 years of slow avalanche, traditions and culture that have slowly eclipsed, buried, and morphed what we know to be the biblical model Jesus gave us for the mission, the it? And so the question that the book is raising is, like, first of all, here are some symptoms in the church. We look at 90% of people in the church pews don't want to talk about why Jesus is who Jesus is. 80% of the people in the church have no Bible study, no fellowship, no prayer life. They come here, Jeff, 1.7 times a month. But those are symptoms. That's the iceberg above the water. Underneath the waterline are the causes. And we listed 6 historical traditions that we think are problems. I won't list those right now. I'll just say that there are 6 out there. I'll give you an example of one just to play with that leaders get trapped in. The not main thing. We get into the business of chasing the institution instead of the actual mission Christ gave us. And that's very normal. Managers like to manage brands, market share. They're trying to climb the ladder. The Disciple Dilemma is asking the question, do we as church leaders actually have the ladder leaning against the right wall,
man,
to steal from Peter Drucker?
Absolutely. Great question. Yeah.
And in that, we look to leaders and we say, would you please consider the model of discipling that Christ gave us, which is you go first. You first. Have you been discipled? Do you have wingmen? I'm borrowing Air Force terms. Sorry about that, Ranger. We have wingmen who are flying alongside of us to keep our six, our backside clear, to help see problems, to help make us better. And are we inviting others to come along with us? To say it slightly one other way, American Christianity does an absolutely fabulous job at exegetical preaching, at deep theological, intellectual resources. Stuff on the web is fabulous. Programs are fabulous. Seminars are fabulous. Here's the challenge. Have you ever been apprenticed by somebody to start practicing the reason for the hope that's in you, 1 Peter 3? And then have you let somebody like a Jeff take you out on the world in your vocation and say, watch how I interact, mimic me, and pretty soon I'm pushing you to the head of the line and I'm dropping back and you got it. That's kind of the short story.
You don't even have to tell me who Sly Fox is. Just to mention his name, what he did for you, and why he did for you what he did for you, I was thinking to myself, every single person listening needs a Sly Fox, needs somebody who's been there, somebody who recognizes something in you. They grab you, maybe even you didn't expect it or didn't even necessarily want it at front, but they grab you and say, you're coming with me. And then they start to show you something, and eventually they show you something and it starts to make sense. And you start to figure out how to do the thing that Sly Fox was showing you how to do. And then they turn you loose. And I mean, literally turn you loose to go do this with somebody else, which is the 2000 years ago. That was the model that Jesus had in mind, that this thing will turn the world upside down. If you will just do this thing, it will literally change human history.
There's the it.
Yeah.
The it is, I am laying down my life and surrendering as a, the Greek term is doulos, a bond servant.
Yeah.
I am now bankrupt and shackled to Christ, following him, not veering left or right, right? As I go down this path, and it's my job description to go make disciples who make disciples who make disciples. And I want to say this because Jeff's on this podcast as a pastor, and I say this as many times as I can. Folks, get over the fact that you think it's Jeff's job to make disciples. Yes, he will disciple, but he's not the hub of the spoke. He's the coach on the sidelines, and you have to be on the playing field.
According to Ephesians 4:12, you are the hub of the spoke, and I am just there to help you go out and to do the work. We're throwing the word disciple around. And even in churches today, when people use that word, they scratch their head and they have kind of a very fuzzy, if any, idea of what this word means. I give an analogy. I'm going to tell you what my analogy is in just a second, Dennis, about what this word would really mean, like in 2024 vocabulary. But how do you describe this word to people that are saying, okay, I hear what you're saying, but I've never seen this. Nobody's ever done it with me before. What do you really mean by that word? What would you say to them?
Invited by someone, whether you're a believer or not.
Okay.
Coming to check out, who is this Christ? The idea then of setting down or surrendering, the idea of following, the idea of teaming as an apprentice, and going. Those are so the functional statements, but it just boils down to this. Am I a servant of the Most High God? And if so, how do I get into continuous learning and actually going outdoors and inviting others to come see and behold the risen Christ?
I love your description. When I try to make this word easy for people to understand, and I said, you know, in today's vocabulary, we don't have a lot that would replicate what the Bible was using when it used this word, but people 2,000 years ago knew exactly what this word meant. They knew what it entailed, and they understood what you're asking me to do when you're asking me to disciple somebody or be a disciple. So I tell them, you know, the closest thing that I can think of to represent this is a pilot. True story. So I tell them, you know, of course, we're going to give you some manuals and we're going to tell you what the book says. We want you to read the book. You've got to know the book. Don't even get in the cockpit until you know the book. But reading the book alone, and in the case of the church, the book would be the Bible. In the case of the airplane, you know, you're reading the manuals. And reading the manuals alone can't get you there. So we're going to have to put you in the airplane. We're going to have to put you in the air, but we're not going to put you in the air by yourself because that would be catastrophic. We're going to put you up there with somebody who knows what they're doing, and they're going to show you what to do while you're in the air. And then at some point, you know it well enough that now it's time for you to fly on your own. And that's 90% there. But the idea in the Bible would be very much like becoming a pilot. Now that you're on your own and you've flown with somebody, you kind of know it. And then you go do the same thing with somebody else that an instructor pilot did with you. That's what the Bible means with the word disciple. And I'm convinced, Dennis, you are helping people realize real meaning in life. It's not going to be the CEO moniker on your office door that's going to give you meaning. It's not going to be the national championship. It won't be winning the big prize. It won't be all of the money that you ever wanted in your bank account that's going to give you meaning. It's knowing that I'm doing something that's going to matter 10,000 years from now. And there's really only one thing, if to use C.S. Lewis's it, that will matter 10,000 years from now. Everything else is frankly temporary, and everything else is ultimately going to let you down if you put too much hope in it.
I love that.
You released the book, The Disciple Dilemma. If people are interested in getting a copy of the book, where do they find it?
Well, it's scattered in all the usual retail outlets, including that thing that starts with an A and everybody knows how it ends with an A and a .com. If you want that, right? But all the major retailers have it as well. And go out to our website, take a look at the stuff we're talking about. You may think we're nuts, and you might think this actually has some traction. We're at www.thedisciplesdilemma.com. There's a YouTube channel with a lot of interesting folks out there, which I some will include Dr. Stricker here very soon on one of our podcasts. There's an invitation
of
if you didn't notice that.
I would be honored to do that. Yes.
Good. So you can check us out in all those places, and we pop up in churches occasionally talking to people about the disciple dilemma.
Okay, so for those of you that are driving right now, we're going to put the links to what he just said in the notes to this episode. Because it's on Amazon, I'm guessing that there's a digital version of The Disciple Dilemma out there. Is that correct?
There is, and I'll just as a sweetener on this, I'm going to toss a dozen free download codes over to Jeff.
Oh, you're awesome, Dennis. You're beating me to it, because I was about to say, I'm going to go out and buy a copy of The Disciple Dilemma and give it away to somebody who's watching or listening to this episode today, but you just one-upped me. Actually, you just 12-upped me. So yeah, if you want a copy, all you have to do is be part of the unbeatable army, and we're going to give away not just Dennis's 12 copies, but I'm going to give away a copy. So 13 of you are going to get a copy of The Disciple Dilemma for free. I really could talk for hours about organizational culture. I could talk for days, actually weeks, about the church and about discipleship, what it isn't, what it is, and what it should be. But unfortunately, you don't have that kind of time. I don't have that kind of time. So I just want to say, Dennis, thank you for what you're doing right now for the kingdom of God and for what you're doing building leaders who are trained and equipped to make more leaders. And thanks for being on this episode with me.
Jeff, thanks for your ministry. And for all of you who are listening to this podcast and you go to church with this guy, you take care of your pastor. Pastors are one of the most abused. And I know he can take the hits.
I can take a punch. Yeah.
He can take a punch, but he deserves better from all of us. Take care of him. Thank you for your service, both in the green and under the cross, Jeff.
And to you, I don't want us to end this episode without saying thank you for all that you've done for our country too, Dennis. I couldn't agree with Dennis Mark. C.S. Lewis nailed it when he said every human being needs to find the great it, in quotes. And I have met many, many people that are living without meaning because they haven't found it. Have you found it yet? If you're still struggling with the conversation that Dennis and I had, if we said something today that made you start to think or ask some questions, I'm going to make an offer to you. You are welcome to reach out to me. Just send me a question on my website, jeffstrucker.com, and I would love to respond to you. Or you can DM me on social media, and I would love to respond to you about something that you heard Dennis or I say today. We both just said it. Hey, there's a bunch of copies of his book, The Disciple Dilemma, that we're going to give away. And all you have to do to be registered to win one of these free copies is to be part of the Unbeatable Army. That's our totally free email list. So if you want a free copy, why don't you go over to unbeatablearmy.com, because about 13 of you on that list are going to get a free digital copy of Dennis's book. I also want to say, if you like what you heard today and you are brand new to this podcast, why don't you subscribe on YouTube or on whatever podcast platform you're listening on? Because we have another amazing guest, a great guest coming up for you next week. You should also follow us on social media because we're putting content out there every day or just about every day on social media. So on almost all of the social media platforms, you can find us just by searching at Unbeatable Podcast. And you're also going to find amazing people out there like Brian Rhodes. Brian, you are our fan of the week this week. And you're the fan of the week because of how engaged you are, how connected you are. Thank you, Brian, for being so connected to the rest of the Unbeatable Army. I hope Dennis has said something today. I've said something today that has given you a little bit to think about. And I hope that you'll be back with us next week as we do another episode of Unbeatable. Thanks. Have a great week. God bless.
These stories of triumph over adversity will help you handle your toughest days in life and become unbeatable.